Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery. 106.5 FM, KCAA Los Angeles. 10:50 AM, Palm Springs and 102.3, San Bernardino, Riverside. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle and several other stations now. And of course, I'm Al Warren, and joining me is Kev Thompson and Julie Seville.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
Okay. So, again, this is our first week back. We've been gone the month of May. Of course, Kevin takes a whole month off on holidays.
Well, I wouldn't call them holidays, but...
He does. Hey, did you guys... Now, I just of course, the Hawaii volcano's been a big thing, but... Did you see that thing with a 30-year-old that the parents had to take him to court?
Hi, Jake.
Yes.
Yes, that was on the news here, too.
Isn't that crazy? You know, the and now he's appealing the decision. I love that.
That is crazy. I mean, what have we done? What have we done to this past generation?
I just thought, as a parent, there's power for me yet. That's all I thought.
Well, I love the bit when the judge told him to get a job, and he said, "I run my own business." And the judge said, "Well, what is your business?" And he said, "Well, that's my business."
Yes, it's none of yours.
I just love it. I think that it's funny. And he's like, well, it's not like I'm bothering my parents. His mother doesn't do laundry anymore and doesn't feed them.
Not bothering your parents. You're only in court because of your parents.
Oh, I got to love it. I just love it. Now, he's been making the tour, but did you see? So here's your buddy, Alex Jones, gave him, what, $5,000?
I've heard of the interview. I haven't seen it yet, but... After this.
That's crazy. Crazy. It's as crazy as Kanye West. Man, it never ends. And the NFL players, now they face a fine if they take a knee. Huh. Wow.
Yeah. That I thought that was a little bit bizarre.
Yeah, so much for, free speech, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so and joining us, the other voice you hear on there is Edward Butts. He's the author of many books. Hey, Ed, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So listen, this is the first time on the show, so maybe tell people, you've written several books. So tell us a little bit about your history so listeners will know who you are.
Okay, well, I am an author. I've had 20-some books published. Most of them are historical nonfiction. Several of them have been true crime history. For example, I did one book that was called Running with Dillinger, in which the principal of the story is a guy named Red Hamilton, who was a Canadian who was a member of the Dillinger Gang. And one of the interesting aspects of that one was that Red Hamilton was supposed to have been killed in a shooting. However, there is a man who lives in New Mexico named Bruce Hamilton, who is actually, he is elderly. He's actually Bruce Hamilton's nephew, and he claims that, or he's Red Hamilton's nephew, rather, excuse me. He claims that his uncle was not killed at all, but survived the gunshot wound and escaped to Canada and quietly lived to a ripe old age.
Wow.
So that is like one of the books that I've done. And the most recent one is called The Mad, Bad, and Dangerous, Volume 1, which is a collection of true murder stories.
What's particularly special about the Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know? Like, what's kind of the idea behind the book?
It's to try and trying to bring out some murder stories that are not all that well known. There are some stories that are, they're so thoroughly well known that they're iconic. But these stories are some of the less known ones. And I have to admit that I sort of stole the title from the famous story of Lord Byron and Lady Caroline Lamb. They had a scandalous affair back at the beginning of the beginning of the 19th century, and after Byron dumped Lady Caroline Lamb, she told other people that he was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And I just thought that that was the perfect title for a book like this.
What is the most unusual murder crime or crime story that you've come across for this book?
The most unusual. I guess they all would have something about them that's a bit odd. The first story in the book, which is called it's called Mad Shortus, and it's about a man named Valentine Shortus, who was born in Ireland to a very wealthy family. His father thought that he was too much of a mother's boy, and when he was a teenager, sent him to Montreal, where he had business connections, to try and learn how to stand on his own two feet. And instead, because he had been somewhat pampered and spoiled, he wasn't really able to keep a job, and he wound up trying to pull an armed robbery, and he killed two men. And there was a huge trial over it because of the man's social position. The case reached into the highest offices of the country, the office of the Prime Minister and the office of the Governor General of Canada. And there was the big question was whether or not he was sane when he committed the murder. He was found guilty, and something like 2 days before he was due to hang, the sentence was commuted. So he spent most of the rest of his life in prisons and insane asylums. He was eventually paroled, and died as a free man. But he had spent the better part of his life in prison.
Now, during your collecting of these stories, were you ever able to interview the actual killers?
No, most of the people that I have written about are dead, but there was one story that is connected to my own hometown of Guelph, Ontario, This occurred in, the murder occurred in 1984. There was a group of brothers, their last name was Wood, and they were a pretty bad outfit. I mean, everybody was scared of them. They were involved in drug dealing and robbery, and, this young woman who had been an off, on and off again girlfriend to a couple of them, was murdered because she was going to be a witness against them on a robbery charge. Mm. And the motive behind the murder wasn't so much that the brothers were concerned about doing a bit of time because of robbery. It was because of all the money they would miss making from drug dealing while they were in jail. So her body was found floating in Lake Ontario. And eventually three of the brothers were sent to prison. There was a fourth brother that was a member of the gang, but he was already in prison when the murder was committed. And recently in my town, they had a sort of a historical event in which all of the light posts downtown had banners from them commemorating various incidents in the city's history. And for some reason, for the year 1984, the people who put up the banners decided to put the pictures of these four criminal brothers to mark that particular year. And they said it was because they wanted to show that, you know, the city has, this history has a dark side too. And there was a bit of a local uproar about it because there are still people in town who knew that girl, and they didn't think that these guys' pictures should be, you know, displayed downtown on a banner. And one of the things about it is that if you go downtown, there is a shopping center that was one of the last places that she was seen alive before she went to the bar where she ran into these guys and then was not seen again.
So the issue is actually them memorializing the killing by putting up posters of the men.
Yeah. Some people objected to that. They didn't think that these guys' faces should be displayed on a poster downtown.
I can kind of understand that. Do you think it would have been more appropriate then to maybe put up her photo and as a victim?
Yeah, perhaps. Or I would have chosen a murder from the more distant past. If they wanted to show the dark side of history, not something that was quite so recent. And when I was doing some of the research on the story, I was interested to find, like, because these guys had been born in Scotland, and even though they grew up here, like they were brought here as children, they never became Canadian citizens. So when their prison time was up, they were all deported back to Scotland. And one of them had such a reputation for violence that no commercial airline would take him. He was sent back chained to the flight deck of a Canadian military aircraft.
Transportation, they used to call that, didn't they?
Yes, yeah.
Sorry, Kevin. Can I just ask Ed a question?
Sure.
There's, you know, an amazing collection of stories, Ed, and I'm sure there's a little bit in all of us that is absolutely intrigued with the psychology around why people do what they do, and especially when it comes to committing some, you know, heinous crimes of murder. But what is it about? How do you go about researching for your books? How do you make sure that the message you're giving across in your books is as balanced as it possibly can be?
Okay, one point that I always try to make in the introduction of my books is that I never try to glamorize these people that I write about. I don't in any way condone their actions, and I try to not write in a manner that sensationalizes criminals. I try to tell the story as objectively as I can, and I like, I think it is important that we read these stories and know about them, because I mean, our history does have a dark side, even though we need not celebrate it with banners on a flag on a light pole downtown. But we do have to come to grips with criminal behavior and why people do the things that they do, if we are to understand it.
Absolutely fascinating subject, isn't it? When and I think you're absolutely right, because history in any stretch of life tells us about the future. So, you know, once we understand why people do the things they do in terms of murder and criminality, then obviously we can put measures in place to try and prevent it. What's been one of the most difficult stories for you to research, and why?
What are the most difficult stories for me to research? I found that the one that I just discussed about the Wood Brothers murder of Karen Ann Thompson was a bit difficult, because it happened right here in the city where I live. And I know that there are people in town who knew her. And so when I'm writing, I have to bear in mind that this story could be read by people who were very close to her, and I have to make sure that I don't do her any sort of an injustice. I don't want to seem as if I'm trying to capitalize on somebody else's tragedy.
Of course. Of course. And how does that equate to other books, other stories? Because, of course, every story has a family behind it somewhere along the line that may pick up that book and read it. So how do you, is that the same, or was it more powerful because it obviously you might bump into these people? And
well, given the geographic location, yeah, that one was a little bit more so. I can say that I have heard from relatives of other people that I have written about. In one of my other books, I wrote about some people who were bank robbers in British Columbia, in Vancouver, and they wound up being killed in a shootout with the police. And I named them. I did much of the research through old newspaper articles, as well as provincial archives. And sometime after the book was published, I actually had a letter from a woman, I believe she was in Manitoba, and she said that one of the bank robbers I wrote about was her uncle. And she said that the family had never spoken about him. She didn't really know anything much about him, only that the other members of the family, like, if his name came up, everybody would just hush up and nobody would say a word. And so she wrote to me because she said she wanted to thank me for letting her know what had actually happened to her wayward uncle.
Is there a story, Ed, that you've looked at, you've researched, and you've begun to write about that you then decided that you cannot publish?
I, off the top, I cannot think of one like that. No, I usually by the time I start writing a story, I've looked at it pretty well, and to, you know, see what everything was that went on and who was involved, and to make sure it's a story that I want to write. I can tell you that there was one time that I did not accept a project that was offered to me by a publisher. As you know, there have been people who have been sent to prison for crimes of which they were convicted, and then many years later it's determined that they were not guilty and they were released. And there are a few names here that are pretty famous because of that. And there was a publisher that wanted me to do a collection of stories about people who had been sent to prison and then released. And it just sort of bothered me because I thought, you know, a lot of these people, these guys spent a long time in prison and then they are released, and some of them they have to live under another name, and I just thought maybe they've had enough written about them. They want to forget about it. And I could be wrong, but I just thought that I would feel like I was being intrusive on their privacy, even though they have been written about to a great extent in the newspapers and magazines. And I just thought some of them might just say, oh, come on, isn't enough enough?
Well, let's revisit an earlier point that you just made in that answer. Have you, in your investigation of any of these crimes, have you ever come across any evidence or any testimony that actually goes against what was said in court? Did you turn up any evidence that may exonerate somebody?
Well, you know, there for recent crimes, I can't say that I have. There is, however, another story. Now, this is getting a little bit off the topic of criminal history, but well, maybe not. I don't know if you're familiar with the name Simon Girty. In the American Revolution, he fought on the side of the British, and he had the nickname the White Indian because he was said to lead Indian raids against the American frontiersmen. Against frontier settlements, and he has a terrible reputation in the United States. He's one of the worst people who ever lived, as far as some of the lore about him is concerned. But I wrote a biography about him, and I discovered that a lot of the criminal activity, a lot of the savage things of which he was accused, were simply not true. I mean, he was a pretty rough character, but he was, you know, really no worse than some of the other frontier people of the time. And as far as the native people were concerned, he was something of a hero because he fought against what they considered was the American annexation of their land. So in that sense, yeah, I think I did find something, plenty of evidence that exonerated him from some of the worst stories told about him. That book, by the way, is called Simon Girty, Wilderness Warrior.
Simon Girty, Wilderness Warrior.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's one of the books that I have written. It's of my own books, if I may say so. It's one of my favorites.
Now, let me get your take on something that's here recent in the news. The Golden State Killer was recently captured. Back in April, I believe it was April, Allen, wasn't it?
Yeah, just shortly, yeah.
Okay, now, would you... do you have any plans, or is this kind of how you select your cases that you write about?
Well, that one will probably get a lot of news coverage, and I'm sure that there will be people writing about it. I like to try and find the ones that have been overlooked. Or maybe they were they might have been big news at one time in the past, but then they have been somewhat forgotten.
Now, in the selling of your books and the marketing, have you ever caught any heat from family members or people who knew the victims or the killers?
The closest thing I've had to that was. In one of my books, I had a chapter on a guy known as Blackie Odette. Now, Blackie Odette was a career criminal. He spent time in Alcatraz and other notorious prisons, and he wrote a book called Rap Sheet. he had the help of a journalist with that, and in his book Rap Sheet, he laid claims to, oh, that he robbed banks with John Dillinger, and he robbed banks with Pretty Boy Floyd, and he was with the Capone gang in Chicago, and it seemed that almost every well-known criminal of the gangster era was a buddy of Blackie Odette. And he also told about pulling a big train robbery in Canada and being sent to prison in Canada and then making this spectacular escape. And when I started doing research, I found that, like, almost all of it was baloney.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he just made it all up. And the journalist to whom he told the story just took it all as fact, and they produced this book. So I included a chapter in one of my books about Blackie Odette, and I mean, I did talk about the crimes that he did commit, but about how a lot of, well, he would have made a pretty good Hollywood screenwriter with some of the tales he told. Now, I had a letter sometime later from a young woman who turned out to be Blackie Odette's niece, and she was a bit angry about what I had written in my book, and she said, I should sue you for libel and so on and so forth. And I replied to her, I said, well, listen, you know, I'm not the only person who has found out that Blackie stretched the truth a little bit. I said, you know, he did do some other things. You can still claim that you have a colorful person in your family background. He just was not the master criminal that he made himself out to be. And she
right.
seemed satisfied with that.
And that is so common of criminals to do that. I work in corrections, and a lot of them, they feel that it gives them a lot of credibility inside prison if they tell these extravagant, you know, stories.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not me saying it about him. It's them saying it about him. I'll just write what you say.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I know that you have to take a lot of it with a pinch of salt. Even when I'm reading the newspaper accounts of some of these people, when I have to get into archives and you know, dig out the old stories, and you read what the various robbers and killers and what have you had to say, and you have to take a lot of it with a pretty large grain of salt.
Here in the UK, I mean, I've been fortunate enough, I suppose, to interview people in prison. And we seem to be here a little bit more open about everything, where they prisoners ask for the paperwork of other prisoners to prove their crime. So that happens less here, I believe, than elsewhere, because there's a culture within our prisons of prisoners asking for the paperwork of other prisoners.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not sure about the UK. I know that here, some information can be pretty hard to get, especially if it's more recent history. For older material, there is information that's available in places like Library and Archives Canada. I've found information there, even online, for people in Canada who were hanged for murder, for example. And there is also Canada's most notorious penitentiary was the Kingston Pen. That was sort of like our version of Alcatraz. And the old prison, excuse me, the old prison is now a museum. And they have archives there as well, and I have written to the Kingston Archives and gotten records of prisoners, you know, criminals who were in there a long time ago.
Now, when you were writing books like Running with Dillinger and the story of Red Hamilton, and other forgotten Canadian outlaws. Did Dillinger come through Canada, or was he related with some of the other gangsters up here?
Well, there is a story that he once crossed the border with Red Hamilton and was at Hamilton's family home in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. Now, that's a story. Whether or not it's true, who knows? There was also a story when everybody was looking for Dillinger and couldn't find him, somehow a story came out that he had made his way to Canada and he had boarded a ship in Quebec and was headed for the UK. And they radioed to the ship's captain to tell him to be on the lookout for the people amongst his crew, that one of them might be John Dillinger. And when the ship landed at the UK, Scotland Yard detectives were waiting, and they went on board and they searched high and low, but there was no sign of John Dillinger. Now, some people have said that it really was not Dillinger who was killed that day in Chicago, and that he did escape, and that he laid some bribe money in the right hands, and that he did actually get on that ship and make it to the UK. But that's a story.
Hmm. Was there a lot of gangsters that were up in Canada at the time, or is it just spillover from the U.S.?
Well, there certainly was crime. I think we had a couple of notorious guys. Like in the 20s and 30s, there was a guy named Red Ryan who was a notorious bank robber, and he pulled a big escape from the Kingston Penitentiary, and that he was recaptured in the United States, and years later he was paroled. And he was sort of like the poster boy for prison reform. He was giving speeches on, don't lead a life of crime, crime doesn't pay, and what have you. And then one day in the city of Sarnia, two men tried to rob a liquor store, and they were killed in a shootout with the police. And when they pulled the mask off one of them, it was Red Ryan. And then in the late 40s and 50s, we had the Boyd Gang in Toronto, who were notorious bank robbers, and they were eventually captured and went to jail. A couple of them were hanged for murder. I think maybe one of the differences is that Canada didn't have a film industry to make big budget pictures out of the, people like John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd and Babyface Nelson and all these other characters.
Oh, so there were some gangsters up in Canada, but just they didn't really make any movies about them.
Oh, yeah, there more recently there actually was a film made about the Boyd Gang. I don't think anybody has ever done one on Red Ryan, but when you think of some iconic American movies like Bonnie and Clyde, we haven't really had anything like that.
Have you considered expanding outside of the US and Canada and looking at example gang behaviors in the UK?
I actually did a little bit in Mad, Bad, and Dangerous Volume 2, which is out now in Kindle. I still don't have a paperback copy, but there was the first chapter in that book is about Dr. Thomas Neal Cream. And he actually was a doctor and a serial killer. And he left a trail of bodies in Canada and the United States and the UK before he was finally caught and hanged. He his preferred method was poisoning, And he actually is, when people come up with a list of names of who might have been Jack the Ripper, his name is one of the ones that is considered, although he's not really a likely suspect because he was in prison at the time that the Ripper murders occurred. But he has been given the nickname the Ripper's Apprentice.
What about the kind of the East End gangsters with the, because the Crays obviously are very well known.
That's something that you should mention that, because when I was talking earlier about the Wood Brothers, they actually were given the nickname the Canadian Crays.
Oh, okay.
I did write about the Crays in another book. I did a book for kids called Behind the Badge, which is the story of the history of policing. And it goes all the way back to ancient times. The very first people who were ever called police were in ancient Athens. They were called the Scythian archers. And they were actually state-owned slaves who were more like bouncers than anything else. They were meant to keep order in the agora, the marketplace. But the book comes all the way up through history to the present time, and I do use the story of the Crays as part of my section on Scotland Yard.
See, so much was written about the Cray twins themselves, and yet there were so many different people working alongside them or underneath them, and their stories must be as horrific as the Crays, because they were the ones, you know, working for these guys and working for other gangs. But we don't hear much about them, and that's not recorded very, not in publicly recorded, like the Crays are.
Yeah, I'm sure that, I'm sure that would be true with almost all of the notorious gangsters. They all had a, you know, there's a wide circle of people around them. And I'm sure that in almost every case, if you could pick one of those individuals, you could probably find a very interesting story. Just the same as with the outlaws of the Old West. We hear about a handful of the, you know, the ones who are sort of like icons, like Billy the Kid and Jesse James. But there are the many people who were connected to their lives who would also have interesting stories.
Of course.
You also, I noticed you wrote a book called Wartime. tell us a little bit about that and how you got into that. That looks like the First World War in a Canadian
town.
Yes,
it is. That book uses, the subtitle is First World War in a Canadian Town, and it uses my hometown of Guelph as an example of what was happening in communities across Canada during the First World War. Like, what was happening here was happening just about everywhere. And you had all the problems with, you know, there were shortages of certain things like different kinds of food and fuel. There was fear of the activity of enemy agents. There was the conscription crisis when the Canadian government brought in conscription and not everybody liked it. And how that book came into being was when in 2014, which was the 100th anniversary of when the First World War began, I went to the cenotaph downtown, which has the names of all the people in Guelph who were killed in the two world wars, and I noticed that it struck me that under the listing for 1914-1918, the only name that anybody would really know anything about, aside from their family members, was John McCrae. He was the guy who wrote the poem In Flanders Fields, and he was from Guelph. But I thought, what about all of these other guys? And I started researching the names, and I just found the most incredible stories, and I was having the stories published in the local newspaper and getting a lot of really great feedback from it. And I had just written a book for a Toronto publisher called James Lorimer. I had written a book about stories from Atlantic Canada, and I told him about these World War I stories I had been doing. And he said he suggested doing a book on the city in for that period. So that's how that book came into being.
Well, what do you think about the differences that were in the times during the war back then? Because back then they had a lot slower communication. So what were the people thinking back in places like Guelph?
Well, there was one of the most interesting stories that I came across. I went to the home of this one old gentleman whose father had been killed in the First World War. Now, that's how old this man was. He was 90 something, and his sister was there as well, and she said that they actually had the telegram that their mother had received telling her that her husband had been killed. And the sister said that her mother told her that people actually used to dread the sight of the telegram boy on the street, because that's how families were informed. The soldier was killed overseas. The information would be sent to London, England, and from there it would be telegraphed to the Canadian government in Ottawa, and the Canadian government would send out the telegrams to the homes, like, across Canada, informing people of that this person in your family has been killed. So people actually came to dread the sound of the knock on the door because they were afraid it might be the telegram boy with bad news. And I was told that neighbors are always visiting each other back and forth. If a neighbor was going to visit the home of a family that had someone overseas, when they stepped up to the door, they would not knock because they didn't want to unnecessarily alarm the family who might think it's a telegram boy with bad news. They would shout out, "Hey, I'm here," or something like that, rather than knock. Hmm. And
much like here.
I just thought that was a really telling anecdote. Because people did sort of live in dread, and when some of the sort of eerie things that would happen would be a family might receive the telegram that says your father or your husband or whomever has been killed in action, and a day or two later they receive a letter in the mail from that person. That, it came by mail, so it's a lot slower than a telegram, and that was, the last letter that the guy wrote before he was killed.
Very powerful, isn't that?
Yeah.
I'll just share this brief experience I had the other evening. I'm not sure if you know, Ed, but I normally lead on the paranormal side of things with Kevin on the show, and I'm a psychic medium. So I was watching the Lord Mountbatten concert for the Royal Marines a couple of days ago. It was a 2018 concert, but I was watching on YouTube. And whilst I was watching, a name came straight into my head very, very clearly, William McInally. So I sat there, I was with my husband, I Googled the name, and sure enough, he was one of those killed in World War II. And you know, we were just sat there watching something that was so moving and thinking about the lives lost and the experience of those families and how it's been reported. And we watched various kind of war documentaries. And it was so powerful, that name coming through to me so meaningfully. It's incredible.
Yeah, really incredible. That is amazing. Well, one of the most moving moments that I had when I was working on these stories, a lady came to visit me at my house, and she had a shoebox, looked like a shoebox, with some documents and other objects from her uncle who had been killed in the First World War. And one of the items in the box was a leather pouch. And inside the pouch, there were some bits and pieces of torn up photographs. And the thing was, this pouch had been really badly shredded because he had it on him when he was killed by an exploding shell. And he was killed by the shrapnel, and the shrapnel had ripped up this pouch that he had. I guess it was inside his tunic, and it was sent home with his personal possessions. So she brought it with her when she came to my house to tell me his story, and I picked it up, and I thought, wow, like, this is what this man had on his person 100 years ago at the moment of his death.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, wow, how closer can you get to him than that?
Incredible, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And one other book you wrote was The Rum, Blood, and Treasure, and that's...
That's the collection of stories from Eastern Canada, from Atlantic Canada.
Right, and that was about Captain Jack Randall and rum runners and Al Capone.
Captain Jack Randall was the skipper of a ship called the I'm Alone. It was a rum runner, and it became part of a big scandal because it was sunk by the United States Coast Guard, and Randall claimed that the ship was outside of United States territorial waters when the Coast Guard opened fire on him. And the Coast Guard insisted that he was inside United States waters, so it became something of an international incident.
Wow. So what have you got planned next?
Well, I am working on a story about another one of the Guelph men from the First World War. When I was doing the research in the local newspaper, I started finding letters that this man's name was Herbert Philp, and he was a journalist by profession, but he went to war as an ordinary soldier. So he began writing letters home, and his letters, a lot of them were published in the local paper. And they are just incredible eyewitness accounts of the war. And because, a lot of soldiers wrote letters home, but he was writing with the eye and the expertise of a professional journalist, although not as a war correspondent. Mm. So I have been collecting up all of this material and doing research on his personal life, because I would like to do a book about it. He was in the war for the entire period. He joined up shortly after the war began in the summer of 1914. He went to Europe and he fought in the trenches. He was with the Canadian Army when it marched into Germany after the armistice of 1918, and then he came home, but his health had been so badly ruined by his war experience that within a few months of arriving home, he died apparently of heart failure, and I believe he was just 31 years old.
Oh, wow, that's too young.
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, so... I actually have found his grave in the local cemetery.
Hmm. Well, Edward, it's been a pleasure. So what's your contact information for people if you want them to... of course, we're going to have your book on our site website as well, but if they want to contact you, maybe pass on a story, how would they do that?
They can reach me at my email address. That's edpbutts@yahoo.com.
Fantastic. Well, again, it's been a... interesting. You've written a lot of great books, and we'll have them on our site. And thanks very much, Ed Butts.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you too. I'm glad to have sort of met everybody over the phone.
Monday seems to be everyone's least favorite day of the week, but at Starbucks, we don't think Mondays are all bad. We first walked on the moon on a Monday. The first comic book superhero appeared on a Monday. Big Ben started bonging on a Monday. The first public lift arrived on a Monday. The UK saw its first cinema, weekly weather forecast, performance of Shakespeare's Macbeth, and Space Invaders game, all on a Monday. Around 500,000 babies are born each Monday. And every Monday at Starbucks until February the 18th, tall lattes are just £1.50. See? Mondays can be great.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.